everybody. Welcome to the PC Gamer Show for what's today, January 10th? What's the year?
January 10th.
January 10th,
2018.
It's 20 great teen because there's a lot of great PC games on the way. I'm your host, James Davenport, associate editor here at PCGamer.com. Also with me is Wes Fenlon.
Hello.
Features editor.
I'm still reeling from 20 great teen.
20 great teen?
I'm reeling from that.
Is 20 great... Okay, never mind. I was thinking, what is 2017 if you're still reeling from it?
Like, I mean, that one left a scar.
That one
sure.
Left a scar.
It was a rough
2018
year.
Is just like, it's been too good too soon?
No, I'm just reeling from your the terrible...
Oh, the terrible pun!
The words that came out of your mouth.
I thought you were having a good year.
No. I mean, it's been fine. 10 days in, like, not going to draw any conclusions
yet. Yeah, we're fine. Just going to do this 35 more times. We'll be good.
Also with us, Austin Wood, our indie news editor. How are you
Hello.
Doing?
Hello.
He's now in the center of the screen.
Place of prominence.
Yeah, place of very, very important prominence. You're looking pretty good there, I think. We have a...
I have a nice shrine.
Can reach into your head.
Pull out these thoughts.
Delicious.
Find some pitches for me, for fuck's sake.
Empty in there. So forgive us for any, like, audio issues or video issues because we got a new table, which...
Which changes all
sort of
audio
fucked everything
and,
up
in video.
Yeah. I mean, we had to move everything around, and our video guy, who we would normally consult with on what to do and to check some of that stuff, is gone.
He's at CES right now.
Yes, and we're going to talk about CES because that's still relevant to games sometimes.
The Consumer Electronics Show.
Yeah, yeah.
It's barely relevant to games, but it is more relevant to PC hardware.
Yeah,
a little bit. You know, it's definitely like a smartphone and Internet of Things show, but there's always a little bit of PC stuff there.
Less so over the years, but there's two things in particular we'll get to in a minute that I think are standout. Three, if you want to count the Kodak crypto mining thing, but we'll get there. But to start, I want to know how you guys been doing over break. What's any big changes? You get up to anything fun? We were gone for a while.
Surely. I got a bit of a cold.
Surely. Oh, yeah. That's your highlight? That's what you start with?
Not too bad. I'm getting better. But I played a decent number of games over the break. Not much on my PC. Okay. Not much, like, actually at... I don't think I sat at my desk the entire winter break.
Oh, goddamn.
But I did play some laptop stuff.
Ooh.
I did some Steam in-home streaming a little bit.
I'm going to click this now playing button so people know what we're doing.
Yeah, so I played some Thimbleweed Park over the break.
Oh, hell yeah.
With my girlfriend, which was pretty fun because we previously played through Day of the Tentacle and the remastered version,
yes,
which was a lot of fun. And Thimbleweed Park felt like a pretty good follow-up from that. Having played a sequel to a Gilbert game, why not just go, you know, straight to the source, right? So we played probably
a good chaser,
like 4 or 5 hours of that, something somewhere along those lines. I feel like we're kind of in the meat of that game at this point. We're
right,
pretty into it. It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. I think the puzzles strike a good balance between silliness and not having the, like, really obscure, stupid solutions that adventure games were sort of came to be known for. Most everything's pretty logical, pretty easy to figure out, but is still has an element of goofiness to it. So that's a fun game. I definitely recommend it to any adventure game players.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite this year, and I thought the adventure game was dead. But apparently not.
Not dead.
Not dead. Anything else you get up to?
I did just finish earlier this week Virtue's Last Reward, which is part of the Zero Escape series.
Aha.
On PC, I'm not sure actually how they... I forget how it's named. I was playing it on the 3DS. There's a collection of the games on Steam. Do you remember what it's called, Austin, on the Steam version? Is the Nonary Games something?
Yeah, the Nonary Games. There's a bundle on Steam. I think it might be somewhere else.
Yeah, so the Nonary Games bundle is the first two games, which is 999 and Virtue's Last Reward is like kind of a combo unit. And then the third game is Zero Time Dilemma, which I don't think is in the bundle. I think you have to buy that one separately because it's a lot newer.
A little fresher,
But those games are, so they're visual novels, which I have not played many of, but they have some interesting like time-bending mechanics where kind of the point of the way the game is structured is you're gonna play through and get some horrible ending where everybody dies. You're like trapped in, it's almost like Saw. You're like trapped in this madman's like weird puzzle hell and you have to find your way out. And then the story will end up being this extremely crazy, convoluted, like mix of metaphysics and time travel and just bizarre stuff. So when you play through Virtue's Last Reward once, you'll kind of choose a decision path to go through, and it'll either end in kind of an unsatisfying ending or will actually give you like a to be continued and then force you to go down another story path. And eventually, once you've done all the paths and figured out every piece of this complex story, you'll kind of unlock some extra paths that you'll then go down to kind of get the true ending. So I think I liked the original 999 more, actually, because it's slightly more grounded, which is kind of a weird thing to say about these games because they're
that shit goes off the rails right away in that first one too. Yeah, so to call that grounded,
they're ridiculous. But I have slightly fond of memories of playing that one about 3 years ago. Virtue's Last Reward, I wouldn't say I liked the story that much, but I like the structure of the game. I think it's a really cool idea, the way you play it. It just takes a little too long to get there. Like in 999, it didn't overstay its welcome because I did two paths through that game and I got the true ending. And in this one, you have to do every single path. Okay. So in the end, when you get there, it's like, oh, I get it, how that piece fits into this piece and this is what happens in this timeline. But you got to play it like a good 30 hours to get all that. And that is a lot for
that's a lot of text to read
for an anime text game. It was a little more than I wanted to play, but it's still a really cool game. Cool. So if you're into visual novels, I highly recommend that series.
Right on. I might just, this is a good segue because I have also been playing a visual novel.
Danganronpa.
Danganronpa. You guys know this? Danganronpa. It's really.
I love your games.
Evil teddy bear, right?
Yeah.
That's what I know about Danganronpa.
So I didn't play a bunch of this over the break. I'm maybe like 6 hours into the first game, but the premise is, well, surprisingly similar. It's basically a bunch of students get selected for this very prestigious school, and from there they go to the school, kind of all end up unconscious somehow, wake up, and the school is barricaded from the inside out. So all of the windows are just clapped over with big metal plates, and there's no exit. There's also this strange black and white teddy bear, somehow sentient, maybe a robot being remotely controlled.
What's his name?
Monokuma.
Yeah.
And Monokuma sets out these rules for this school you're in, and you are to live, I mean, on, it sounds nice to begin with, because like you're going to live here communally forever, which kind of sucks. Or you can graduate, and to graduate, you have to murder somebody. But not only do you have to murder them, you have to murder them without being caught. And anytime a student is murdered among these 15 students that you meet up with, there is a trial held. So there's an evidence gathering period. Everyone has like the evening to gather evidence and form their arguments. And then there's this, a trial is held in this, you know, I was expecting something similar to like Phoenix Wright where.
This is a different kind of trial, I'm guessing.
I think it uses some of the same ideas, like you maybe stop a conversation to present evidence, but the way in which you do that, like people might have the floor and people will be discussing an incident or a part of the incident, and you will have these things called truth bullets, and these are, as represented in the UI, literally like chambered up in a gun.
And a truth gun.
A truth gun.
Yeah.
And so the text, so there will be a rolling argument and a timer on screen, or at least a rolling conversation and a timer on screen. And this conversation will like repeat endlessly. So like six people will say something. Oh, I saw so-and-so in the hallway doing this. Well, that means this is, you killed them. No, this means you, and here's my reason why. And if you, your truth bullet, which is represented, or it's referencing something you found in the investigation period. That's what your truth bullets
like
are.
Each bullet is a statement.
Yes. You then literally like have to aim and fire your truth bullet, your statement, your counter evidence, and hit the text on screen to like knock it away and basically
you
do your objection.
Shoot the lie.
Is there a skill element there? Like, can you miss and mess?
Yeah, you can. I'm pretty early on, so I don't know how difficult that becomes. Like, have you played this, Austin? You've played these before?
Yeah, I played the first and second one. Okay. I think it came on Steam a while back, and the third one's there too. I need to pick up.
Yeah. So does that become like a part of the skill test, like actually aiming?
Yeah. Like I won't. I'll try not to spoil too much of it, but sort of as you get deeper, there's sort of more like layered mechanics of things you have to keep up with in the UI. Like there's more mini games added in.
Oh damn.
Where you have sort of starting with the truth bullets and you get more and more stuff to do. So it definitely becomes like, it's not quite like on the level of like the level of a rhythm game, but it's some hand-eye coordination for sure.
I really wish Phoenix Wright had truth bullets so that every time somebody perjures himself the stand, you could just shoot them in the head with a truth bullet and they're just dead and they're out of your freaking trial, so that you don't have to worry about them lying to you 15 more times before you finally figure out what was going on.
I typically don't go for, I think we were talking about this earlier in the week, Wes, is like, I think we like the premise of a lot of visual novels and we like the characters and the style and I certainly like the how bizarre these court sessions are. But I think a lot of visual novels are very long-winded in the way that they, maybe it's a translation thing, maybe it's just like a playtesting thing in that they are, or a cultural thing, like just, you know, as far as anime and such goes. But they really repeat themselves and like really hammer home the same shit over and over.
Probably a big reason why I find them tiring in a way. Like I don't get exhausted reading a book. I'm not in the book. I'm not like, God, there's so many words. This book just keeps having words.
Yeah.
Like, but in a visual novel, I sometimes feel that. And I think it is at least partially a Japanese tendency to restate sort of what just happened or what characters are thinking just ad nauseum. And it's like, I get it. Like I was reading it the first two to three times that you said this, I don't need to read it again. And that just adds a lot of extra kind of cruft and stuff that you don't need. So that makes them pretty tiring to get through.
Pretty exhausting.
But the setups are usually so, at least for the ones that we're talking about, are so weird and fun and compelling.
Yeah. And,
keeps you playing.
The ways in which some people die, are just absurd in this game. And it's like to the point of it's disgusting, but also just hilarious.
And they got to keep the school prestigious somehow. Yeah. You can't let the riffraff survive.
So I'm enjoying it. If only, oh God, what happened to Austin?
Is he dead?
I don't know what happened to him. I don't know. We'll figure out Austin in a minute here. But if only to, looks like we lost the connection on his laptop. We'll figure that out in one second. But if only to just see what the hell is going to happen next, it's totally worth playing. We're going to take a quick like 1 minute thing here to see what the hell's going on with this laptop. So
should I just talk, or are you going to take a break? Should I just orate?
Yeah, just tell us more about games and what you did over the break.
This would be a good time for me to like know a poem or something by heart that I could just go off. What else did I do over the break? I actually played another not a PC game, but a game that I played a good chunk of over the break that's kind of PC adjacent is Mario and Rabbids Kingdom Battle on the Switch, which if you haven't heard of this game, is essentially Mario but XCOM but with Mario and with Ubisoft's little goofy rabbit characters. And that game is really shockingly fun. It was really good.
Yeah, actually I played a good amount of that a couple months ago.
And it's a lot of fun.
I think, Austin, are you back? Can you hear us?
I am back.
Okay,
here.
Sorry about that. Don't know what happened, people. Internet happens. I'll get your face all normal looking in a second. But yeah, just to chip in, I think there's a lot more. It kind of showed me this Rabbids game. We're talking about a Nintendo game, which is going to be good for what you're going to talk about in a sec, Austin. It shows that like the XCOM formula, that turn-based strategy, grid-based strategy, is like there's a lot to do there.
Yeah,
that has not been explored on the PC.
So the interesting thing about it, to me, the most interesting thing is, you know, it doesn't have a lot of the meta layer stuff that XCOM does, building your base, but it does have characters with each character has their own skill tree with some unique abilities and stuff. But it really places an emphasis on movement, which is not really it's not as much of a thing in XCOM, right? In regular XCOM, your positioning matters a lot, whether you're in cover, getting a good angle on the enemy, but your movement abilities aren't really a thing. It's like, get in position, take the shot. In the Rabbids game, every character, you can do like a dash through attack where you can kick an enemy if you like run through their position. You can also do team ups where you'll like leap off of one of your characters to propel yourself further, and Mario can stomp on enemies. So you get in these positions where you can like kick somebody, or you can leap off one of your characters, then stomp on the enemy and bounce off of them somewhere else. So you get in this mindset of, if you're kind of in close quarters, like every turn you should be dashing through them before you take a shot. And so movement becomes a really important part of just getting extra damage in on the enemies every round.
I will say, did you play the latest expansion? And some reason I'm forgetting the name, War of the Chosen?
I have not.
XCOM 2. Some of the specialist classes, I'm forgetting what they're actually called, but like, do, now that I think about it, rope in different kind of movement abilities.
That's cool.
There's one I remember that it's basically a total melee build, and you are rewarded for running up to people and hitting them, because you will get sometimes a bonus move, or you will get a chance to deflect all damage on your next turn. So
nice.
I think XCOM is getting there, and I'm curious to see if we get another expansion for XCOM 2, what kind, I don't know, maybe, I wouldn't doubt, because I do remember seeing some tweets from Jake Solomon,
About
the Rabbids game, and I wouldn't doubt that he's internalizing some of that for sure. And I would hope to see that in whatever we see next for XCOM. Yeah. But as far as what Austin's been playing, it's also a Nintendo game. Welcome to the Nintendo show.
I was among the many people this holiday to open up Switch for Christmas. I helped buy a friend a Switch. He helped buy me a Switch, and there was a bunch of friends and families, intermediary parties.
Yes.
So I've been playing. I've been playing Breath of the Wild, which is what you do when you get a Switch. You go buy Breath of the Wild and disappear. I'm like 50-something hours into it. It's really good.
It's incredibly
good.
It's
just a really organic open-world game. It is. It's very pretty, with like rewarding curiosity, I would say, which seems to be Nintendo's thing between like that and Super Mario Odyssey, where it's not so much like what you find, it's the way you find it. Sort of every inch of it is just filled with stuff.
Some cynical bastard at this table last week or so said something to me about Breath of the Wild, like not having, I can't remember your words. I should look them up and throw them back in your face, about like there not being any wonder or something in the game, because once you find out,
really?
Everything ends in a shrine. It's no longer exciting. And I say, boo to that, sir. No.
I think, okay.
I disagree so hard.
I know this is the PC Gamer show, so I just want to caveat our conversation by just like pointing, first of all, like saying the PC modding scene for this game is amazing, so don't like discount what we're talking about. Also,
yeah, I get what the emulators are on about now.
You can ride on Sonic now.
You can, yes, you can do so many disgusting and beautiful things in this game. But I will say, yeah, I think there's a sort of a threshold. Once you kind of learn the design of the game and like know what it's leading you towards, there's not bottomless mystery in that game. I'll say there's mystery.
You know what that's also true of, James?
What?
Life.
Yeah, damn it. I think it's a very mysterious game for the first 20 hours, which is like a good amount of wonder and mystery. That's a potent dose of wonder and mystery. But the back half of, well, excuse me, the back like 15/16ths of of my like 200 hours in that game or whatever has been a lot of fun, but also sort of just, you know, I'm looking for shrines.
I think even when there is a shrine at the end of it, usually whatever interesting, like the places that they built in that game or the unique areas are totally like fascinating to me by themselves.
The reward
is just to go find like the big sort of like main corners of the map and everything. The shrines do get a little bit samey after a while, but it reminds me more than anything of a game that is on PC. And so I'm sure someone's going to slap me for saying this, but it reminds me of Dragon's Dogma after the Dark Arisen DLC came out for it, where mainly because of, like, I guess the reason I want to explore. Like, in Fallout and stuff, I'm super fastidious about, like, or, like, in Skyrim, of, like, finding every, you know, arrow or every bullet in a dungeon or in, like, a building. But in, like, in Breath of the Wild and Dragon's Dogma, it's more of, like, what's at the end of an area. It's less about like a stockpile of supplies or money. It's more about like a more impactful piece of gear, I guess. Like I'm motivated to explore because I want to gear up as opposed to I want to have a bigger number in my inventory. And that reminds me, that was something I really liked about Dragon's Dogma. And there's just, there's stuff everywhere to collect with food and herbs and like all kinds of crap. But there's like more sort of like every sort of long trek in a straight line is like punctuated with a big discovery outside of a shrine. Which keeps me kind of like checking corners.
I still find so much satisfaction in that game in just like climbing high spaces and just like having a really nice view of something. That's something that I'd never, even in The Witcher 3 is probably the only other open world game where I got kind of close to that, but The Witcher 3 is still to me much more about the story and the side quests and stuff. Than I would admire how beautiful the environment was, but I wasn't really seeking out vistas or kind of like distracted by just a sight somewhere. Like I would be distracted by an event or a character or something, but in this game I'll just be like, huh, that crag looks interesting, like let me spend 10 minutes just climbing, running, you know, parasailing over to it.
And I think I'm walking back my statements from Slack because I'm A, hyperbolic, and B, I love this game.
And I'm bullying you in public.
But I also, I'm just like, I'm so, when I play this game, I think of the PC a lot. Breath of the Wild, for anyone just tuning in.
It is a PC-ass Zelda game, for sure.
PC as fuck. But, and I think it's going to be, I'm so excited for, I don't know how long it's going to take, 3 years or so, for the next wave of open world games on the PC
to take inspiration from it.
Because you're already seeing in tiny doses in Assassin's Creed, Origins, and Far Cry 5, there's an emphasis on, I guess, your own sort of cartography and like seeing, you know, determining points of interest through what you see in the world rather than a top down map that has icons on it. Natural curiosity, and I don't know, I think whatever started this round of open world games with icons just, you know, covering the entire thing, whether it was a combination of Assassin's Creed and GTA, I don't know, we're like on the cusp of something new. We're gonna have some good ass climbing exploration games. I'm so excited.
I think that'll be a good sort of like trend, is we'll get away from all the icons and stuff and just move back to, if you can see it, you can go to it. I look forward to that as well.
Yes,
for a while that was like a really cliche sort of PR talking point, but I think a couple games like Breath of the Wild and Assassin's Creed Origins, like, actually, not only did they make good on that as in a thing you can literally do, but they made it feel worthwhile, which is the which is the part that makes it cool, because it's not just a, oh, that mountain is real geometry, you can walk to it. It's like, all right, whatever. But that when you get up there, it actually feels satisfying.
It does.
Right. And it's pretty, there's stuff to do there once you get there.
Like throw rocks down at lizards. Cool. Anything else you've been playing, Austin?
Not been playing. The only thing other than that I did over the break was meet Wes when he was in town for the holidays.
We did do that in Atlanta.
In Meat Space, right on.
We got some
Mediterranean food, kebabs.
Some halal, some kebabs.
That sounds so good.
And some hummus.
Chatted up in a bar and then some ice cream.
Hey, you got a cap off the night, right?
It was right next to the Mediterranean place. Like, how can you say no to Baskin Robbins?
Back in Montana, I had nothing but like meat and potatoes for two weeks. I miss the food here. It's good food, but I'm glad to be back.
How much of your what's your dad's favorite beer again?
Hams.
Hams.
Dude, he was
hams.
Going hard.
How many hams?
He's like officially retired now. He doesn't know what to do with his time, and a brewery just opened up in town, so
yeah, he knows what to do with his time.
He just goes there. He just spends three beers, comes home, naps, talks about the ducks he saw that day, and yeah,
that's a life. I could
that's retired dream.
I think
right
I could
there.
Be content
yeah,
with that.
Oh hell yeah, I'm down. Anyway, let's move on from what we've been playing. I'm sure we'll have more in the coming months, but to just some fresh news, fresh off the news boat. And right now I don't have my remote scene switcher working. This stage is a work in progress for those of you watching, so I'm gonna lean out.
You know, if you didn't point it out, probably no one would even pay attention.
I'm just so as the host with the most, I can't boast. Here we go.
Pow.
Wow, that was dramatic.
News.
Woo,
that was pretty. That's some smooth show running, if you ask me. Two things I wanna go over. Guess what was announced today?
New Total War.
It's New Total War, and it's the new. This is not a new fantasy game that they've been stuck on those dang devs for
not
a while.
Not a Warhammer mm-hmm. game. Yeah.
Not a Warhammer game. This is the next mainline historical Total War, and it's Total War Three Kingdoms, and that takes place in ancient China,
yep.
190 CE. So, as a person who's not familiar with the history of China and not too familiar with the history of Total War games, I don't know if this is exciting or not. Are you guys getting the general idea that people are into this?
You know, I
I'm kind of in the same boat. I want to hear from Total War fans.
Me.
Wes,
are you yeah, a Total War fan?
Yeah, definitely. So I started playing the series with Shogun 2. One of my good friends has been playing it since probably the early games,
yeah.
Like the original Rome or something like that. So he played through Empire and Shogun and Shogun 2, and that was about when I jumped in. And that's probably still my favorite in the series overall. Shogun 2 is a really good game, and Rome 2 kind of blew out the
yeah.
scale a little too much. It had a lot of issues at launch that they, to their credit, they fixed most of them, but it was still a really huge game. And Warhammer is a ton of fun. The factions are so creative and different, and they play really differently. But the historical Total War games, you have to admire their dedication to the settings,
mm-hmm.
and they really go out of their way to integrate, even though the games are mostly about combat, to integrate some kind of different political systems. You know, Rome politics, obviously very different than
yeah.
Classical Japanese politics, that kind of thing.
Right.
And this is the first time they've done a really new setting, I think, in a pretty long time, because they did some kind of small sequels to...
Yeah.
To Rome, and Shogun had kind of a big DLC, but the I'm trying to remember now what the it wasn't Mongols the Rome 2 the last one, it felt like kind of a gap game. It wasn't like a huge big change. This feels like I'm gonna be a more significant new Total War game to me. So I haven't even watched the trailer yet, actually, but it's I'm pretty excited for it. I think it's going to play differently than Rome, probably a little more like Shogun, but
cool.
has more distinct factions. I'm really curious what kind of the size of the world map is going to be, how the political stuff is going to work.
Cool.
But it's a new time period for Total War, so I think that's pretty...
A lot to be excited
about
awesome. For the historical fans.
All right.
Cool. What's in news? Destiny 2 recently finished up its Dawning event. Austin, did you do any of that stuff?
I did not. I did absolutely none of that stuff.
Neither did I. I kind of fell off the Destiny boat, I think,
yeah.
for a little bit. Just as this holiday event is wrapping up, there's another on the way, leaked through some data mining, and it's the Crimson Days event. Previously, this event was accompanied by a two-player, like a duos mode, right? Like, with sort of an interesting mechanic where if a player was downed on one team, the other player would then receive a buff of some kind. It's not confirmed whether that mode is coming back or not, or what's going to be in this, but this was officially acknowledged by one of the community managers, so it's on the way. If you're still playing Destiny 2, and you still, and the Eververse hasn't ruined your life and love for that game, then you got more stuff coming, I guess. Personally, I don't know, that Dawning event really soured me, but
yeah, that was that left a bad taste in the mouth. Crimson Days was fun before. Like, duos is, I think, an underrated format for shooters. It's like, it feels less special now that Destiny 2 is a 4v4, because it's like we cut the teams in half, whereas 6v6 was like a bigger departure.
Yes.
But like, picking a battle buddy is still fun. And if the rewards are cool, maybe I'll give it a shot. But it seems, from what we've seen so far, it looks like there's a lot of loot boxes with this event.
Yeah.
So,
oh boy.
That's not really going to pull me back in after the Dawning.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
We'll see. We'll see how it, when it's officially revealed and everything.
Yeah. At the very least, I hope for a new mode that sticks around.
Right.
That's, you know, we need more variety in that game. So that's it for the news. Our first topic, though, there's still more news to come, but happening this week in good old Las Vegas is the Consumer Electronics Show, historically known for just big TVs.
I am so happy I am not at the Consumer Electronics Show right now.
Not yet.
Well, there's some cool stuff happening.
Yeah, but CES is the worst convention to cover.
Why is this, Wes?
In my experience, I haven't been to Gamescom, which is the European nightmare of a bajillion people being in this one convention space.
Yeah.
But CES is typically overcrowded. It's in a giant convention center, so it takes forever to get from one place to another.
Yeah.
And then when you go outside, it's Vegas air, and so by the end of a week, you're like, either you've been smelling cigarette smoke just constantly, or the desert has sucked all the moisture out of your body, and you're just
desiccated.
It's just not. And then half of CES is like phone cases and Bluetooth speakers and just like the most boring, generic shit year after year.
I like phone cases. What's new in phone case tech?
They fit your phone better.
Oh, good. Great.
Yeah, they probably don't.
I mean, well, okay.
But there's always a few cool things at the show. A lot of times the companies will show up with, like, when I went like 5 years ago,
yeah,
it was like they had an 8K. Somebody had an 8K TV
five years ago.
That TV was never going to be an actual product.
No.
It took like four HDMI cables to run, you know, picture to it or something.
Hot damn.
So there's always some just, you know, super prototypey stuff that's just for show, that's never going to be real. But then there's some stuff that's like, okay, this is going to come out later this year and it's going to be legit.
Cool.
And I think one of the big ones this year is NVIDIA announced their BFGD.
What does that stand for?
Initiative. I think it's big format gaming
displays.
But that's,
yeah,
this is maybe the first time I can think of a company using some like gamer vernacular,
right?
that doesn't make me totally cringe. I was kind of like,
a bit on the nose,
I like
but...
it. So basically NVIDIA is partnering with some tech companies, I don't want to say display companies, I'm not sure exactly what the arrangement is here, but some companies like Acer and Asus are going to be making essentially gaming TVs, but they're kind of marketing this as like a hybrid between a monitor and a TV, I guess. But they're 4K displays.
Damn.
They're 65 inches.
Okay.
So that is a, I guess these days that's like a standard size for a big TV.
Yeah, I was gonna say, right, what you've said so far sounds par for the course.
Like I think I have a 60-inch TV, which
is
pretty good size for my living room.
Yeah.
65, great size TV. 80 is kind of like the higher end. 80, 90 are like as big as they get, kind of as normal these days. 65 inches, rather large for your desk, I would say. Not too many people have a desk set up.
I'm not going to be.
It would accommodate that.
Writing a report.
You're going to have a hard time finding like a dual monitor mount for that.
God damn.
But they're 4K. They do HDR. They're 120 hertz displays. They're going to have NVIDIA's Shield tech built in.
Right.
Which makes me wonder if they're going to be doing more with that at some point, because it's been like 3 years since they had their Shield home streaming box thing, and the Shield tablet and stuff, which is basically what the Nintendo Switch is. Fun fact, is the Shield tablet. So I'm wondering if they're going to have some updates on that, the Shield TV and whatnot. But yeah, they're basically making some big ass G-Sync enabled gaming TVs.
I mean, that's sort of been, obviously I'm not going to be able to afford this, and
they're going to be expensive probably.
Yeah, we don't know the price, we don't know availability, anything like that. But I think what bothers me most about playing, hooking up my PC to my home TV, is that the refresh rate is so low. And when I go from you know, a work monitor that has, you know, I think I'm at 144, and it's just like butter, to go from that to very just kind of it feels choppy, especially on such a big display. It's maybe exaggerated a bit, but I think this is for enthusiasts, hardcore enthusiasts. For now, this is probably exciting news.
So they're coming out later this year, apparently. They haven't said anything about pricing. They will probably be $2,000 or more, I would guess.
I think two is pretty generous, but yeah, we'll
maybe three, 2.5.
You don't see a lot of high refresh rates on 4K.
That to me is like the big selling point.
Yeah,
is because it's really hard to find a high refresh rate on 4K.
And prices for 4K in general are coming down for sure. Yeah. And HDR is no longer like you can only get it in the top end models, you know. But that 120 hertz refresh is going to be the big selling point for this for a TV, I think. One thing that might help with the price a little bit is all of these, because they're all going to be 65 inches, they're all definitely using the same panel. So that should at least mean they can ramp up production on that pretty high. It's not going to be like a big competitive thing where different TVs are using different panels and they all have to do their own manufacturing. It's very much going to be, we're using this display, different companies are kind of going to do different frames for it and presentation. But
cool, that's exciting. One more big, well, one good announcement I think from CES for another enthusiast one is there's a new Vive headset coming out. It's called the Vive Pro VR headset, and the big improvement this time around is resolution. And if you've used VR, Austin, have you used VR? Okay, you've used VR OS.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
There's a screen door effect from the resolution, the low, relatively low resolution compared to maybe the displays you're used to of your phone.
Right.
Because you're putting this thing right next to your eye, you're going to see, you know, the pixels, essentially, and the way the screen is manufactured. Because the resolution is so high, it's 2880 by 1600. That's a 1440 by 1600 per eye, approximately. That's a 78% increase over the previous Vive and Rift, relatively. Tuan, who tried it for us, he said the screen door effect is still there.
Yeah, but very minimal.
Very minimal.
He said big difference.
Right.
Big difference. So, along with an improved headband, you know, better headphones, integrated headphones, it sounds good. It sounds like nice improvements. Do you think this is going to change anything for
VR? I think it's going to change like a good bit for one of like the two VR markets, which is the people who can't afford VR.
There you go.
So it's good news for them. They have a better screen, they have clearer visuals, but it's obviously not going to do, I think it's going to do good stuff for Vive, but not good stuff for VR, where it's still, it's, you know, bigger screen, bigger price. It's like we're expecting it to be like 800, right, for the new one.
That's my guess is at minimum 800, maybe 1,000.
Right.
Yeah.
So we were talking about the Vive.
The Vive Pro.
So I think it's definitely a plus in that it is pushing the hardware forward.
Yes.
And the only way this kind of high end hardware becomes affordable is you have to make enough of it that it gets cheaper to make it, build a market for it, sell it, and the Vive and the Oculus both started out at like $800. You know, the Oculus is now like $350-$400. Yeah. So it's become much more affordable. The only way something like the Vive Pro with a new higher end display is going to become affordable is for them to put it out there and let that technology become more profitable for them. So it's good in that sense. I don't think this is going to expand the VR market significantly at all. It's going to be a few people who went, okay, I'll finally buy in because I was waiting for that second generation. And it'll be a few people who just have a ton of money who go, well, I have one already, but this sounds better, so I'll buy a new one.
Right.
But it's not going to be the big expansion that, you know, it'll take to make VR mainstream or something like that. So good, but not going to make a huge difference.
Cool. Well, that's exciting. Those are the two big bullet points from CES so far, but there's still a couple days left. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple more days. Yeah, Razer has a new Mamba wireless mouse that they took an interesting tactic with. So a lot of companies are doing wireless charging now where you just have, you do like the magnetic field technology. There's a little puck in the mouse that connects to a mouse pad.
Yeah, yeah.
You plug the mouse pad in and that'll charge the mouse. So Razer with their new Mamba actually took the battery out of the mouse. There's no battery in it. So it's not charging wirelessly. It's just holding a connection, a constant charge. Wirelessly, so maybe there's like a tiny battery or something in there, but it basically has to stay on the mouse pad to work, to function. But as a result, it's like a 95 gram wireless mouse, which is very light. That's about as light as mice get. Some of them drop into like the 80s if they're wired and very, 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 very light. So that's a cool way to cut some weight out of the thing. You're gonna have to have the wireless mouse pad, obviously, for it to work. The wireless charging mouse pad. So it's a very specific setup. It's not something that you would take with you probably anywhere because you need to plug your mouse pad in and have it set and sturdy and all. But it's a cool idea.
That's exciting to me. Yeah. I'm sure we'll see. Some more stuff later this week. You can head to our website, pcgamer.com and
/hardware
to see all of the stuff coming out of CES.
Currently, CES has no power.
Yeah.
maybe it's back up by now.
I mean, like, at least we still have power here. But yeah, CES is exciting, I suppose. You know what's more exciting is video games, things that you play. A game I played before break but recently wrote up was a game. Let me tell me if you've heard about this game or had heard about it prior to maybe me bringing it up. Kingdom Come Deliverance, anyone? Let me change the subject here.
I've definitely heard of Kingdom Come Deliverance. Let me give you the elevator pitch for what I think it is. Extremely technical immersive sim in medieval Europe.
Yeah.
Combat.
Pretty much nailed it. It's a first-person historical RPG. At a glance, you might think this is Skyrim because first-person melee combat, pretty vistas, a lot of castles and you know, that kind of, and monks and familiar kind of trappings of fantasy. But, you know, the actual, or at least as approximated as it can be, the historical versions of these in a digital form. This comes from Warhorse Studios, and this was originally a Kickstarter project that has been delayed a few years by this point.
It was projected December 2015, apparently, so about 2 years old, two years late now.
Yeah, I think for good reason, or at least hopefully for good reason, because there's a lot going on in this game. And speaking to some of the devs, they've expanded, their studio has expanded by a significant amount in that time. So the scope of the game kind of also changed with it. First person RPG in Bohemia, 1400s Bohemia. And you play, and this is, I think, the thing I latched onto immediately. You don't play a hero exactly, you play the son of a blacksmith. Who his village gets attacked and his family's killed and a family heirloom is stolen, a sword, and he's just like, I don't have anything to live for, so I'm gonna try and get that back because that is like, it's all that means anything to me. and a kindly lord, and this is the greatest bending of the truth, says, okay, you can be a soldier now. You can work, you know, fight for me, which is typically something that would not happen. You kind of were in your class and you stayed there.
But you're still kind of just one of the grunts.
Yeah, you're a grunt. And that's reflected in a lot of interesting ways. And I think, you know, when you play Skyrim or something that appears similar to this kind of game, there's sort of an inherent like power fantasy that comes with it. It's like you're going to start on this slope that where you maybe have very little, and then you hit 5 hours in, you start unlocking points on your skill tree, and you just like the gains and your abilities just multiply from there. This is, imagine starting even further below that. In this game, you have to learn to bandage yourself before you can heal yourself in battle. So you might just get cut open in battle, and you might have the materials to bandage yourself,
bleed out,
but you won't know how to do it. So you cannot. There's a quest line in which you have to find, and I love this quest line overall. There's videos of it online that on the dev's website that go into more depth, but you have to find a murderer in a monastery, and there's all these new initiates in the monastery, and the murderer is one of them. And so you have to become a monk, and
it's very like In the Name of the Rose kind of inspired, which is cool.
Yeah, so you know a guy, because like you can't just become a monk right away. You know a guy, so you kind of bend the rules and get in. But from there on, you cannot leave the monastery, and you have to live the life of a monk, like on a real-time schedule. Not real-time, but you know, according to this game's day and night cycle. So you have to, you get a schedule to begin with. You have to do like morning prayers, you have to be in the mess hall to eat, you have to, you know, maybe do some hymns, or you might be scheduled to make some potions or whatever, and you have to show up to these places on time. The catch is that you can't read either, because you're lower class, you know, medieval Bohemia. So you essentially, and it was not told to me how you go about learning to read or learning to decipher your schedule. They just kind of jumped me ahead and said, you know, you'll figure it out on your own. But yeah, you have to,
wow,
you know, you're truly kind of role playing this low class uneducated guy.
It's like that's a dedication to subterfuge that I can't think of any like full-on stealth games really replicating, or you know, something like Hitman, like you get the chef's disguise to get into the manor or whatever, but like do you really does Hitman at any point, I haven't played much of the series, like let you kind of fake the professions that you're doing? Definitely not.
You can
scale.
Like stand at a table and like chop stuff up or something, like if you're
Hitman was my first thought too, but it never goes really that deep.
Yeah, and this may be just be a one-off quest, but it is at least, if you fail and like you fail to perform your duties and get kicked out, the quest will not end. You will still like have to find this murderer, or have the opportunity to just
kill all those monks.
And you could just kill all the monks. that probably like will have consequences, but that's an option.
You probably wouldn't be real popular ever after that.
No, I don't think you could return to that place. But I don't know. I just kind of, that really stood out to me as like a nice gem of a quest, and sort of exemplifies the dedication to role playing this character. There, the other thing that really stands out to me is sort of the battle system and hit detection. So I know you wrote a thing maybe a year or two ago, Wes, about The Witcher 3's like armor system and how you really liked
visually.
Yeah, I think this gets close to it visually, because I think it shares a lot of the same styles.
I wrote about how The Witcher 3 is, I want to say, really the first game that I can think of, or at least definitely the one that made the greatest impression on me, of it feeling like the characters were actually wearing these clothes rather than the clothes being just part of their character model. Like they had enough thickness and like layers and pieces to them that it felt like just something that had on top of their body rather than their body is the clothing.
Yeah, and so I think this game reminded me of it, Kingdom Come Deliverance, for those of you just tuning in, because first of all, visually it appears layered, and when you switch out items, there's not like, you know, one layer poking through another, and it doesn't feel like it's just bending around like a rigid character model. It feels like, you know, it looks like clothing. I think it carries that depth mechanically and systemically too, because you have 14 slots for clothing and armor, all of which you can layer and match.
That's
like
a lot.
However you like. So yeah, that might be a turnoff for a lot of people, because inventory systems are, you know, they're you're in the menus and you're dinking around with stuff and it takes a long time.
Right.
A lot of numbers and small text. I admire this because not only do these, you know, 14 slots change your stats in unique ways, but each material responds to each weapon type accordingly and realistically. And by that I mean you could be wearing plates, you know, maybe on your chest and on your thigh, and, or maybe all over. But it, you know, at some point you need to be able to bend your arms, and so there are small gaps in the armor, even if it is full armor. If you happen to pierce that with an arrow, it's going to behave. If you happen to nail the spot between the plates, you could bleed out and die, like, right away. It could be a critical hit. So it doesn't matter if you're facing like this big berserker type you might typically encounter in a game. If you have good aim or you play smart, you can just take them out as easy as anyone. That's a challenge. That's a small hitbox. Another example is, like, if you have a visor with tiny slits in it, if you just manage to poke a guy in the face once or twice, you know, through the visor, they're done for. Like, how often are combat systems that?
That's pretty rad, yeah.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah.
Pretty challenging. And there's a whole stamina management system and, like, almost a four honor style directional counter and you know, aim system for all of these different weapons. But there's just a level of detail there that will turn off so many people. That
but the people who like it.
But yeah, but the people
really
who
like it
are losing their mind over this kind of thing. And so,
right,
like, that's extremely exciting to me, maybe not from, like, a casual playtime standpoint, but
70 hours in, you're going to be like, I finally
understand the armor system.
Yeah, I finally have 14 pieces of good armor and know how to stab dudes in the elbow.
Not only that, your armor and clothes will degrade, and, like, if you get into a battle, they'll become dirty and bloody, and if you don't wash them or take care of them, people will just, like, turn you away and won't
really.
Finally, a game where I can do laundry.
It's what we all been waiting for.
I hope that has real repercussions and isn't just like a convenient back of the box quote. Because I remember in the original Dragon Age, just laughing hysterically, like watching one of my friends play it, where you would go out and do a battle, and in Dragon Age, like, your characters would just be covered head to toe
gore
within seconds. Like, 10 seconds, you stab like a pig and it's just blood drenching you.
Yeah.
And then you go in a conversation and your character is just like entire face is just coated in blood.
What's up, Greg?
And it's just like, oh yeah, I got those apples you wanted.
Oh, thanks, buddy. See you later. That's not the case in this game. And I mean, it goes further. You guys mentioned Hitman. If you wear the clothes of a noble or wear the clothes, or which are difficult to get in this game, and by no means can you just find them. Well, maybe you can.
Maybe you can just kill a noble.
I mean, that's what the thing is. You can kill a noble, you can kill a beggar, or you can feasibly knock them out and steal their clothes and dump them in the woods. People will treat you accordingly to how you're dressed too. And that carries over to different factions. So if you want to infiltrate an enemy fort, one option is go under cover of night and sneak around, and you can, like, poison their chili, and the next day in the battle they might be weaker or have worse stamina, or one or two will die.
Shitting themselves.
Exactly. Or you can, like, find the guy taking a pee, or who's, like, maybe the scout, you know, walking the perimeter of camp. You can kill him, knock him out, steal his clothes, and the more items of that faction you're wearing, the less likely you are to be detected or, like, as an imposter. There's sometimes, like, other checks. They might, like, be Turkish or something, and you have to speak their language, and there's a skill check there to go along with it.
Wow.
But if you've been doing things in the game that, you know, up your charisma or speech or whatever that associated stat is, then you might be safe. But
so Kingdom comes out in a month?
Yeah, that's what surprised me the most. This is a really interesting looking game. It's probably a year off. No, it's out February 13th, I believe. It looks just like a quintessential kind of PC game, ridiculous attention to detail.
And from what you got to play, did it feel ready or did it feel buggy or?
I didn't see any overt bugs. What I played were very much like, it felt like curated slices of the game.
Yeah.
Right.
That no doubt they've been hammering it away for a while.
Pretty polished segments.
But I don't know. I feel like we've approached with like maybe The Witcher 3 initially with the same skepticism, like this is really ambitious and the previous games these people have made maybe don't match up to what its ambition kind of says it's trying to be. And I'm erring on the side of
hope
rather than it being just a total mess, because everything there is, the attention to detail is such that like if they were to just release it in a buggy state, or a super buggy state, it would be a disaster. And I don't think these super complex games can really afford to arrive broken. Sort of some of their brokenness is like inherent to the stack layer systems. But
like for sure, if it's really buggy, if it's crashing all the time,
that's
there's things that just don't work, obviously that's going to be a big problem. But yeah. I think there is definitely a degree of jankiness that is more acceptable in those kind of like really ambitious open games than in something more polished and linear like our lights just dim.
Yeah,
here.
That's the other catch about this room is we have
a motion sensor
blocked by a shelf at the moment. Work in progress, everybody. Work in progress. But yeah, it's a cool looking game. We'll be sure to be writing about it and playing it and have a review and the typical things we do accompanying the launch of big things that you might like.
You know what you talking about actually reminded me of the most recent, I believe, update to Dwarf Fortress, which I think is in the game now, but it has at least been discussed on the blog. It has a whole system where you can adopt a fake name, a persona, and every interaction you have with characters at that point, like you can do that for one of your elves or not one of your dwarves, rather.
Right.
Every interaction they have, the thing, this is for the adventure mode at that point, people will just associate that name with you. And then you can just start going by your own name or a different name. And all of the conversations and all of the actions you've done and everything under that name, people will only know of in that name, which is like a level of simulating reality that most games wouldn't go to because it's just too hard, too complicated. But like, James, if you just went to Minneapolis and you were like, I'm Doug, and then you became really famous in Minneapolis, and then you just came back to California and you were like, I'm James, nobody would fucking know about all that stuff you did as Doug back there.
Oh my God.
It makes me wonder if you like get caught, you know, someone identifies you as both.
I think there are ways for that to happen, but I haven't played it myself.
Dwarf Fortress, they keep going going.
I'm still in love with the idea of Dwarf Fortress in all ways, and I can't wait for it to never be finished. Cause
it can't ever be finished. I hope it just keeps going and surpasses reality. Final topic of the day. So Opus Magnum, it's this interesting...
Is it puzzle
alchemy game? Based? What is it? Do you know exactly what the?
Yeah, it's a puzzle game where you build these alchemy machines. So you have inputs and outputs basically, and there's like basically like these hexagonal tiles, and as stuff like passes over these tiles, it'll turn into something else or combine with something else. And you have these little like grabbers which move stuff. So you build these machines, you basically like program them with sort of inputs of like rotate in this direction, grab this, and stuff like that, and then you just try and build either like the fastest machine or the most efficient machine in terms of like the least sort of work done, the least parts used and stuff like that. And that to me is like the magic of Opus Magnum, is it makes programming fun. And I say that as someone who's not a programmer.
Yeah. And we liked it a lot. Our reviewer gave it like a 91.
Yeah. Which it was like a 91. It was one of our top reviewed games last year.
Yeah. That's a pretty big deal.
It had a built in, I believe, tool to like output GIFs of your machine,
perfect.
Which was a brilliant, idea, because you'd see on, it was fun watching some people on Twitter as they were learning the game, like post kind of a machine where it's like the arm would rotate, you know, 180 degrees and pick a thing up and then move it over here and then slide it down. And then a week later, they're tweeting a thing with like 74 moving pieces in this like insanely elaborate sequence.
Perpetual
like,
motion machine.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, it's really cool to see that progression.
Yeah, yeah. It looks amazing, but it's not amazing enough for GOG. And so you wrote this new story, Austin. Can you kind of talk us through what exactly happened here?
Yeah, so a few days ago, the creator, Zach Barth, who is Zachtronics, he made Opus Magnum and a couple other puzzle games. It's kind of his thing. I think maybe the most known one outside of Opus Magnum is Infinifactory,
it's a good one.
Which is like a conveyor belt puzzle game, which is really cool. A lot of people were asking him, like, hey, why isn't Opus Magnum on GOG? And he reached out to GOG to get a publicly like releasable statement, which he put on Twitter. And basically, it was a statement from GOG, which we reached out and confirmed with them as legitimate, saying basically Opus Magnum did not pass our internal curation process. And then they gave a little bit more detail, basically saying we consider many other factors than just the actual game. We do it from the entire like the angle of our entire user base. And what's funny is they name dropped PC Gamer, saying the reviews we do aren't objective game reviews like what PC Gamer does, which Tyler pointed out in
a
comment.
Such thing.
Our reviews, it's like our reviews aren't. Yeah, like I get what they mean, right? Like they look at it as a product on our shelf. We look at how fun our game is. I get what they mean, but our reviews aren't, you know, objective. They're sort of by nature. But anyway, yeah, that was the story. Is that Opus Magnum, really popular, really acclaimed game, rejected by GOG, and it sparked this conversation over how these types of storefronts are curated. So like on one hand, at one end of the spectrum is GOG, who with this sort of incident has kind of convinced people is very strict with what's allowed on there. And what's interesting, as some people pointed out, is that Zachtronics' other games, a lot of them are on GOG, like Infinifactory. And then on the very far end, we have Steam, which, you know, a bazillion games came out on Steam last year, and like 95% of them were crap. We see so much like garbage meme games clogging the Steam storefront because stuff like Steam Direct just doesn't have has a really wide filter, so stuff like that slips through. So it's like, is it, you know, is a system like that preferable where we get everything, or would you rather have a system where like maybe we miss a gem like Opus Magnum, but we have a stricter sort of bar there? So that's kind of become the conversation as a result of that.
And what do you think the right way is? Like, what do we take from maybe not this specific instance, because I think it's just mystifying why this game isn't, you know, good enough.
Right.
But
it makes me very curious, like what the criteria was or the reasoning for why it did not pass muster to them.
So then, what's the solution, Austin? What do we do? What do game fronts, storefronts do?
Yeah, I guess like it's kind of a boring answer. It's like to look for a middle ground,
compromise.
Yeah, basically, where it's like, but and then it just. I'd be like, curious to know what other games were in this situation that didn't get you know, this sort of like coverage around them. What other like we consider really good games weren't on GOG for this same reason? They didn't pass the curation process. But GOG wasn't particularly eager to comment further on it, so I don't think we'll get an answer from them. But yeah, looking just like as to how you want to curate things, I guess it kind of points to like the advantages and pitfalls of automated versus an actual human curator.
Mm-hmm. I think at the very least, I think transparency across all storefronts for whatever their process might be is important. Because as a creator, if I was a creator, if I was making a game, you know, I would want to know if I'm spending my money, and making something that's going to be able to even appear on a storefront to begin with. And I don't know, I think GOG is putting itself at risk through this particular instance and maybe further by saying whatever we feel like is whatever we want.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it would be like a powerful weapon for indie devs, prospective developers, to know what those criteria are. I think that's a good idea. It's like, because then that like they can start be planning on where they're gonna put this game after release. And it's, I guess it would be easy, like because there's so many, you know, unknowns with Opus Magnum. We don't know exactly why it's not there, why it was rejected. But I think it's easy for some developers to look at that and be like, well, if Opus Magnum can't get on GOG, then you know, what chance do I have?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a potentially, you know, sort of downfall of a situation like this, but that's more of as a result of ambiguity than anything.
Yeah, and transparency makes you back up your rules, right? Or makes you back up your claims as to what, you know, what your rules are for your store, what your criteria are, or whatever. Same,
right?
The kind of thing like we've seen with Twitter, for example.
Yeah.
Is you yeah, there are all these like people who go after Twitter saying, you know, why don't you ban all the Nazis from Twitter? And like they, you know, why did this person like sending me death threats? Why did this tweet, you know, not, why was this not considered, you know, inappropriate behavior or whatever? Mm-hmm. And they have to refer back to their rules, and then they say, well, based on our rules, blah blah blah. And that has been a way people have kind of eviscerated Twitter's rules.
Yeah.
It's like whenever they fall back on that, inevitably they have a very like shaky leg to stand on based on kind of the vagueness of their rules and their kind of sliding justifications for them. So the more transparent you are and the more robust your criteria, your rules, whatever they are, the more satisfying that answer is when people say, what are you doing? What the hell is this?
Yeah, it'll be interesting going forward because I don't think I think all these storefronts are still like, we're going to see a major change in how they curate and present the many games coming out. In particular, like what Steam's UI does, because we know this UI update is still happening. Does GOG, you know, against that, do they become more transparent and try to be sort of a more prestige platform? And you know, how these storefronts are going to carve out their identities is going to be real interesting. Hopefully it's not by just introducing more clients, because I'm so sick of fucking clients. There's so many desktop clients.
Yeah. GOG Galaxy is pretty nice though.
It is good. Yeah. It is good. I like GOG. The platform is nice and the DRM free stuff.
I appreciate the, you know, I would still be fine if GOG was all old games. That's probably not a great business model. There's a reason.
Anymore.
There's a reason they're selling, you know, newer games.
Kind of run out of them.
But every time that they still re-release something that, you know, isn't on Steam yet, and an older shooter, an older anything, I'm just like, I'm happy that they are around and putting time and resources and money into doing that.
Yeah.
Because that is a tough thing to navigate, all of those weird like licensing issues with companies that have gone bankrupt, and who owns the rights to this, and how do we re-release it, and how do we set up, you know, an emulator like DOSBox correctly to run this game so that it's not a pain in the ass. Like, that stuff takes a lot of work. I'm glad they're still doing that.
And that service, you know, really distinguishes GOG as a storefront. And like you said, Wes, if they were to become more transparent about this process, it would kind of put pressure on them to back it up. But it could also be another good way for them to separate themselves from Steam, who also doesn't have a great sort of transparency in terms of what is and is not accepted on Steam. So,
cool. I'm looking forward to 2018 when all of this is sorted and figured out.
Yeah, I think this is the year we solve all problems with PC gaming.
Everything.
Fix it all up.
No, we're doomed. We're doomed.
Should we do some questions?
Let's do some questions. It's time for the Twitch chat Q&A.
Some Q and also, should we do that? Should we do the answers too?
I guess we'll answer them. We can just read the questions.
Yeah.
Just let them hang there.
Let the chat answer them.
That's good TV, right?
That's good TV. So we're starting off the questions with questions from our Discord, our club Discord, PC Gamer Club Discord. And if you don't know what that is, you can go to, what is it? Is it PCGamerClub.com? Or no, PCGamer.com/club.
There you go.
Gosh, it's been a long break. I couldn't remember my social security number, and this is not related at all, but my memory is failing me because traveling to Montana and spending a bunch of money and then coming back, they locked my credit card thinking, who's this guy in Montana? And I could not remember my my social security number when the fraud, I was talking to the fraud lady. She's like, okay, to prove this is you, what's your social security? I'm like, I could not remember it. And so I was like, wait, let me be right back. And I sounded like the most suspicious idiot ruffling through drawers looking for it.
Yeah, like, hang on, I have to wake him up and ask.
It eventually came to me and I did prove myself. Point is, you can go to pcgamer.com/club to learn about our monthly subscription service, which gives you an ad-free experience on the site. It gives you access to our club Discord, which is just a good time. There's a lot of people in there. It's growing all the time. Siege has recently taken over Rainbow Six Siege, so that's the game to play.
Not Under Siege, the Steven Seagal movie.
That's definitely not that. You get a digital subscription to the magazine. You get a free game each month, and whatever beta keys we get enough of, we'll throw your way first. You also get Tub Gear wallpaper, so that's a good thing. Most of all, you get to hang out with us. Your questions get answered here first. But if you have questions, tag PC Gamer in Twitch chat, and we'll if we have time, we'll answer those as well. Starting off here, Nick Manley, 1987, asks, could all the people in the stream briefly go through one of their most anticipated games for this year? So that means you two. What are you looking forward to?
So like a game that's coming out
in 2018.
In the future.
In 2018. What are you looking forward to?
2018.
Austin, you want to go first?
Yeah, easy one for me. It's still Monster Hunter World, even after the recently announced delay. We're getting it. We're hopefully getting it in fall, they said. And we had some more news on that come up today about explaining it. And it's, it's the good delay. We want to get it right and all that.
I guess technically it's not a delay because they had never said when it was coming out on PC. But
it's just like
the console version is out in, 3 weeks or something?
What is today? Yeah, 2 weeks. The 26th it's coming out on PS4 and Xbox One. So, which gives me enough time to, play it to death, and then by the time we get it on PC, I'll be ready to probably do it again.
Destiny 2 all over again.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll give you two.
All right.
One, Vampyr.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like action RPG, murder mystery kind of game from Don't Nod. Who made Life is Strange.
Yeah.
And before that, they made a kind of like a cyberpunk action game called Remember Me.
Oh, yeah.
But what we've seen of Vampyr looks pretty cool. You're playing as a doctor who is a vampire. And the setting looks pretty morbid. A lot of people die into the plague, and it's
I'm into it.
I guess 18, maybe not 1800s, 1500s. I don't know. I forget the setting offhand, but it's in the past. It looks very gothic and interesting. Like there are dialogue options. It definitely has that RPG flavor, but then you can go around fucking dudes up as a vampire.
Yeah, and I'm trying to stay away from reading about this game, which is hard in our position because that's what we do, but it's so intriguing to me. Like I read a snippet, and I'm probably paraphrasing and destroying it, but I think you can turn just about any main character into a vampire. That's like one of the big RPG systems. Who you turn and why.
I seem to remember that somewhere. We can kind of have these I don't know if they're minions to you or not, but you can sort of expand your brood, as it were.
I think there's a vampire word for that I don't know it either.
Cool.
But second, not a game that has been announced in any actual shape or form, but From Software has got to be putting a game out this year, right?
Dude, better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to be Dark Souls.
No.
There's probably going to be a Bloodborne 2.
Yeah, I would
that's
bet.
Definitely in development. That's probably not coming to PC because it's like a Sony joint. But I think From Software is working on at least two games. And
they're working on
three.
Last update for me is like it was three.
Is one of them a new Armored Core?
I don't think they ever confirmed it, but it's like
probably an Armored Core
unofficially.
So that'll come to PC most likely.
I would hope so.
I feel like they've got to be putting something out this year because it's been 2 years almost since Dark Souls 3
was late 2016, I think. November 2016 or something.
No, I thought it was like March or April or something.
Oh yeah, it might have been early in the year of 2017, last year. No,
is that recent? Can't even remember.
No, because Ring City was early last year, so it was the year before that. March 2016.
It's been a while since Dark Souls 3.
Yeah.
They haven't shown anything since then. I thought they were gonna have something like the Sony games show a couple months ago. Haven't seen anything, so...
Just that annoyingly short teaser from the Game Awards.
That's right. Very, very
but
short.
Who the fuck knows?
So I feel like they're going to go, oh yeah, here's a game. It's out this year.
I hope so. I really hope they just blindside us with it, because discovering the systems and the settings that they've created is like the best part, I think. So even those front missions.
Hopefully
series.
It's not just PlayStation exclusive.
No, damn it.
Right.
PC needs it. For me, I don't know. I honestly, right now, all I can see is Kingdom Come Deliverance. I doubt I'll ever finish it.
Blinded.
But it's soon, and it seems big, and it seems like something the PC audience will be super into. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see the depth of its quests and systems.
Yeah.
And everything it's got going on. Yeah. Did you answer, Austin? Did I talk over you?
He went first.
That's right.
Got it.
Monster Hunter.
Monster Hunter World.
All right, we'll move on to the next question from Maniac86.
I'll throw you one more.
Oh, God.
Dragon Ball FighterZ.
Oh, shit, yeah. It looks really,
it's like next
really
month.
Cool.
Yeah. It's going to be good.
That's by the, is that by the Guilty Gear folks?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Arc System Works.
A really cool, like, 2D, 3D blend.
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be the rare fighting game that... breaks out of fans of its particular niche. Like, I think there will be a lot of people who don't care about Dragon Ball who will enjoy that game.
Yeah,
because it looks
right.
It looks amazing. Cool. Good call. Maniac86 asks us to share some of our earliest nostalgic gaming memories. He says, I remember sitting in my dad's lap, taking turns playing Red Baron and Hellcasts on an Apple II GS. Do you guys have any early gaming memories? Super fond gaming.
Definitely. I mean, I actually have a pretty similar one, sitting in my dad's lap playing a thing that we actually wrote. We actually kind of did this question in text form not that long ago on the site. I think it was either what was your first PC game or earliest memory, something like that. And I used to play this game. I think the name was LHX Attack Chopper. You can find this article on the site. If you do a little Googling, I'm pretty sure that's the name of the game. And it was a helicopter sim that you would just go on these missions to like do bombing runs or rescue hostages or whatever. And it's all like first person cockpit.
Yeah.
With a bunch of different simulated helicopters. It's like an early 90s just DOS game. You could fly an Osprey, you could fly a Black Hawk, and basically my dad would control the helicopter.
Nice.
And when other helicopters would come after you, they'd be trying to shoot you down with missiles or with machine guns, and there was like a button to launch a chaff that would distract a missile potentially. And then also flares, and you'd have to use different ones in different situations to keep things from hitting you, basically. And that was my job, was to just like hit those buttons at the right time, basically.
That's awesome.
Maybe I shot like the machine gun too, I can't remember. I would just sit there and play that with him, and we would almost always crash and burn on every mission because it was a really hard game, but occasionally we would succeed and
that sounds like fun.
Land with like the bullet holes in the glass and stuff, so that was always cool.
All right, on
fun game.
Nice. Austin?
I guess like my earliest stuff, I wasn't into PC gaming when I was really young.
Yeah.
I was a Nintendo kid. My earliest like PC gaming memory is probably like what I had my parents got me like my own computer for the first time from my room. It was like one of those old sort of off gray like Dells or whatever, maybe an HP or something, like stock 512 megs of RAM or whatever. And I remember so proudly getting two more sticks of 512 meg RAM. Because I thought I needed it to play Halo 1. and I played that game to death after it with that PC with like a terrible frame rate, but triple my stock RAM.
Incredibly good game on PC. Really like a kind of poor performer though. Like I think you needed probably higher end hardware than it should have actually required to run it properly. But man, that game felt great on PC. Pistol headshots all day.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Blood Gulch, take me back.
Yeah.
For me, I wasn't allowed to play games as a kid, but I do remember, or at least like, my dad did not understand that you could play computer games on a computer. So we had a computer, obviously, and my mom bought me a the TIE Fighter X-Wing collection.
Oh, that's a good mom.
And a joystick, like a flight stick. Like
holy
shit. It was like a cheap, shitty Logitech, like, you know, probably bargain bin thing, but it was enough to play that game.
Do you think you'd have this job right now if your mom hadn't bought you those two things?
You know, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question, because I played a shitload of that. Like, I would wait till my dad was, I don't know, fishing or out doing something, like, go into my room and, like, from under my bed, pull out my joystick and collect some CDs and go upstairs and hang out in the menu. Do you guys remember that menu? You must register. You must register. No?
I don't think that was before me.
trying to remember. I've played, some of X-Wing, and I've played some of TIE Fighter, and I can't remember if I played X-Wing versus TIE Fighter or not.
I didn't like that as much. I think TIE Fighter was my jam.
TIE Fighter was legit.
But just really, really good times. That really kind of communicated to me. Games, I don't know, games weren't limited to two-button Nintendo gamepads and a joystick, like in careening through space in 3D.
It's kind of mind-boggling controls. Yeah. For that was Star Wars in the 90s.
Yeah.
That was like the biggest representation of Star Wars.
It was mind blowing as a kid loving that series. Like it blew my mind. But anyway, I'll quit waxing poetic about good times and move on. We're gonna talk about now, specifically about Butts wants to know our thoughts on the Vive going wireless. So I don't. Is the Pro, this is maybe a misunderstanding on my part, the Pro is not wireless by default, is it?
I believe it's an add-on. Pretty sure it's an add-on.
Right.
I could be wrong about that. I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure it's an add-on, though. There is already an existing third-party add-on, but this is like an official HTC one that's going to use Intel's Y-Gig technology. And I don't know. I'm still a little skeptical. I think I'll be skeptical until I use it.
Yeah.
That the image quality, you know, isn't compressed, that it looks just as good, and that the latency remains, you know, indistinguishable from wired, which was kind of the big issue. The reason there hasn't been wireless before now is your latency in VR is incredibly important. It needs to be as close to zero as you can get it, and wireless is much, much harder to do that with than wired. But assuming it checks all those boxes and works well, that's one of the biggest hindrances for desktop VR, is being tethered to that cable. So that'll be great once that technology becomes good enough to be the standard.
Yep, just another tiny step towards becoming the ideal, you know, what VR should be before any like mainstream audience can really get into it.
For sure.
Pretty much my thoughts exactly, because if you can have good wireless VR, that really opens up the number of play spaces you can have in your house.
Yeah, definitely. It's exciting.
James, we're stuttering again.
Well, we have one question.
Oh, no.
Our audio is still fine. So
I'm gonna ask it and then restart the camera real quick. Not going to stop the stream. But Janrin asks what our thoughts are on the abundance of meme games on Steam.
Meme games. Oh, what do you think? I don't know if I have any thoughts about meme games beyond just like meh.
I guess it's kind of hard to define, like, well, maybe not. I guess if you see a meme game, you kind of know. I'm trying to see if I can find anyone.
There are a lot of them that are just there for just real either shock value or just easy cash in on the most, like, the most obvious possible joke, you know, that comes into your head, that's just the most generic you know, mass market thing you can think of.
I guess it kind of goes back to our curation conversation a little bit. I guess the fact that there's like so many kind of says something, but something everyone already knows about Steam's curation process. Other than that, they're just kind of like too easy to ignore, to get upset about.
I will say I prefer them to the App Store's common issue, which is just like a bajillion clone games that are obviously using the you know, like the game itself probably doesn't look anything like Mario, for example, but they're just using like an icon that is just a straight ripoff of an existing game, like literally using the box art from some released game to sell your like shitty spamware. Steam doesn't really have that problem. Like occasionally something like that will pop up, but I'll take somebody's dumb like emoji game on Steam over like literally selling a lie, you know, that is that is someone else's property.
Yeah, and I think I'm gonna regret saying this, but I think sometimes there are good meme games that are occasionally.
You haven't played any meme games, James.
These micro games that are like very obviously just simple jokes for like $2. I think occasionally you get some good ones, and I'm glad to a very limited extent that Steam can allow for that. I mean, like Alston was saying, they're so easy to ignore. They like dust in the wind. You know, new releases on Steam. There's, you know, still plenty of like robust, fully formed games that you can just gloss over, like whatever. Pepe the Frog rides a bike. The game, I don't know.
Right.
Easily.
Right.
I agree.
But other than that, yeah, whatever. I think they're memes.
Yeah, I think in the same vein as what you said, Wes, I prefer meme games to like the achievement farm games that are on Steam, where it's like you press start and get a billion achievements because that matters to some people, and like there's like the cards or whatever. Those are a lot better than those.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see again. This is back to our curation. I have no doubt that the Steam UI update, which we thought was going to happen like a year ago when, you know, some assets leaked supposedly, I wouldn't doubt they pumped the brakes on that because of the new problems that Steam Direct sort of introduced, or at least like the glut of these games that started appearing maybe because of, or maybe not directly because of Steam Direct, and how they do or do not surface that kind of stuff. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. 2018. 20 great UI and great storefront curation, 18.
You can't just put any word into 2018 that you want to.
20 great pasta, 18. 20 great Austin, 18. Right, 20
I'm
great
done. I'm done with you, Jay.
Wes, 18. I'm done with this. I'm done with this as well. That's all the time we have this week on the PC Gamer Show. Thanks for watching. You can always catch up on youtube.com/PCGamer for the video on demand. You can go to PCGamer.com/tag/podcast for links to our iTunes subscription. You get our RSS feed there, and just, you know, download the MP3 directly if that's your jam. Until next week. Until next week in games.
Tweet at James. Tell him you 2018 him.
Don't do that.
Yep.
Don't. No. 20 great teen, not 2018. Damn it. Like yin and yang across this table. We'll catch you next week. Thank you. Goodbye.